Capital and Ideology isn't just a book, it's an intellectual earthquake. Since its publication, this 1,100-page opus has been hailed as the most important economics book of the year and maybe of the decade by The Economist, while The New York Times called it a sweeping attempt to write a global history of inequality and the ideas that sustain it. Celebrities from Bernie Sanders to Greta Thunberg have cited its insights, and it has become required reading in university courses across disciplines. What makes this dense economic history so compelling? Piketty's radical yet pragmatic vision challenges our most fundamental assumptions about capitalism, property, and justice, showing that extreme inequality isn't inevitable, but the product of political choices that can be unmade. At the heart of Piketty's work lies a revolutionary claim. Inequality is neither economic nor technological, but fundamentally ideological and political. Throughout history, societies have justified their inequalities through elaborate ideological constructions. From medieval Europe's three-tiered society, clergy, nobility, commoners, to America's racial hierarchies, to today's billionaire worship, these justifications appear natural and inevitable to those living within them, until they suddenly collapse. These narratives often persist for centuries, becoming deeply embedded in social institutions, legal frameworks, and cultural beliefs. Consider how the divine right of kings persisted for centuries in Europe, or how racial segregation was defended as natural order in the American South for generations. Every human society must justify its inequalities. Unless reasons for them are found, the whole political and social edifice stands in danger of collapse, Piketty writes. This perspective directly challenges conventional economic wisdom that treats inequality as the natural outcome of market forces, technological change, or globalization. He demonstrates how similar technological advances have led to vastly different distributional outcomes across societies, undermining deterministic economic explanations. For instance, Japan and Sweden embraced similar technologies but maintained much lower levels of inequality than the United States, suggesting that political choices, not technological determinism, shape distributional outcomes. The data Piketty presents is staggering and multifaceted. In 1980, the top 10% captured between 25 to 35% of national income across India, the United States, Russia, China, and Europe. By 2018, this share had risen to between 35 to 55% everywhere, with the most dramatic increases in the United States and India. This growth came directly at the expense of the bottom 50%, whose share fell from 20 to 25% to just 15 to 20%, reaching as low as 10% in the United States. Particularly striking is how this pattern repeats across different political systems and cultural contexts, suggesting common underlying mechanisms. In the United States, for example, the share of income going to the top 1% has reached levels not seen since the Gilded Age, while real wages for the bottom half have stagnated for decades. But these numbers aren't destiny. Piketty meticulously documents how societies have dramatically reduced inequality through deliberate political choices, progressive taxation, public education, social insurance, labor laws, and power sharing in corporations. For instance, top marginal tax rates exceeded 80% in the United States and Britain for several decades post-World War II, while inheritance taxes helped prevent the concentration of wealth across generations. The mid-20th century compression of inequality wasn't accidental, but the result of specific policies implemented after the Great Depression and World Wars, proving that extreme inequality isn't necessary for economic prosperity. In fact, the most egalitarian period in modern Western history, 1950 to 1980, also saw the fastest economic growth, with average annual growth rates exceeding 4% in many developed nations. Countries like Sweden managed to combine strong unions, high taxes, and extensive social programs with robust innovation and economic growth. Piketty's analysis extends beyond pure economics to examine how educational systems, inheritance laws, and corporate governance structures either reinforce or challenge existing inequalities. He points to examples like Germany's co-determination system, where workers hold board seats, and Nordic countries' comprehensive social policies as modern alternatives to extreme inequality. These cases demonstrate that societies can choose different distributional patterns while maintaining economic dynamism and innovation. For instance, Denmark's flexicurity model combines labor market flexibility with strong social protection, while France's inheritance laws help prevent extreme wealth concentration. Such examples reveal how institutional choices shape distributional outcomes far more than abstract market forces. Piketty's historical narrative traces how societies have organized and justified inequality across centuries. The earliest complex societies operated on a trifunctional model, where society was divided between clergy who prayed, nobility who fought, and commoners who worked. Each group supposedly fulfilled essential social functions, justifying their unequal status and privileges. This system was particularly evident in medieval Europe, where the church's extensive landholdings and the nobility's military obligations created intricate webs of mutual obligation and dependency. This arrangement persisted for centuries across Europe and Asia, with variations in India's caste system and China's imperial examinations. In India, the fourfold Varna system added additional complexity, while China's meritocratic examination system created a unique scholarly elite. Though these systems claimed to be divinely ordained and unchangeable, they constantly evolved through political struggle. In pre-revolutionary France, for instance, the nobility shrank from 2% of the population in the late 14th century to just 0.8% by 1780, while the clergy declined from 1.5% to 0.7%, strategic moves by the monarchy to consolidate power. This decline coincided with the rise of a new administrative class and wealthy merchants who challenged traditional hierarchies. The French Revolution marked the decisive shift from trifunctional to proprietarian society, where property rights replaced birth privileges as the foundation of social order. The revolutionaries attempted to draw a clear line between state power and private property, abolishing feudal privileges while establishing absolute property rights for individuals. This great demarcation created a new justification for inequality based on the sacralization of property, treating ownership as an inviolable right regardless of its origins or social consequences. The Civil Code of 1804 under Napoleon formalized these principles, becoming a model for property law across Europe. This proprietarian order reached its extreme form during the Belle Epoque, 1880 to 1914, when the top 10% owned 80 to 90% of all wealth across Europe. The period saw unprecedented concentration of industrial and financial wealth, with families like the Rothschilds and Rockefellers embodying this new aristocracy of capital. Despite claims that this arrangement promoted economic dynamism, it primarily benefited a tiny elite while blocking educational investments that might have threatened their children's privileged position. Public education remained severely underfunded, and social mobility was extremely limited. The proprietarian order collapsed between 1914 to 1945 through the combined pressures of world wars, the Great Depression, the Russian Revolution, and colonial independence movements. In just 30 years, private property was either abolished in communist regimes or severely constrained through nationalizations, progressive taxation, and expanded social rights. Top marginal income tax rates reached 70 to 90% in the United States and UK, while inheritance taxes approached similar levels. This transformation was accompanied by the rise of powerful labor movements, the expansion of voting rights, and the creation of comprehensive welfare states. The post-war period saw the emergence of a new social contract that attempted to balance private property rights with public welfare and economic democracy. The post-war period, 1950-1980, marked a transformative era in which social democratic societies flourished across Western Europe and North America. While maintaining capitalist economic foundations, these systems implemented comprehensive reforms that fundamentally restructured wealth distribution. Through a combination of aggressive progressive taxation, reaching up to 90% in some cases, extensive public services, including universal health care in many nations, robust labor protections, such as collective bargaining rights, and innovative corporate governance models, these societies achieved unprecedented levels of economic equality. Germany's pioneering co-management, Mitbestimmung system, became a model for industrial democracy. Under this framework, corporations with more than 2,000 employees were required to reserve half their supervisory board seats for worker representatives, while smaller firms allocated one-third. This arrangement gave labor a direct voice in strategic decision-making, from investment plans to dividend policies. Similar arrangements emerged in Nordic countries, with Norway and Denmark adopting modified versions of co-determination. Sweden's transformation was particularly dramatic. In 1910, it ranked among Europe's most unequal societies, with the top 1% controlling over 50% of wealth. Through sustained policy intervention, including the Rehn-Meidner model of wage solidarity, active labor market policies, and comprehensive welfare provisions, Sweden became the world's most egalitarian developed nation by the 1970s. The United States, despite its more market-oriented approach, maintained top marginal tax rates above 70% from the 1940s through the 1970s while expanding Social Security, public education, and veterans benefits through programs like the GI Bill. This social democratic compromise delivered unprecedented shared prosperity. The top decile share of national income declined from approximately 50% before World War I to roughly 30% by 1950, remaining stable for three decades. For the first time, a substantial patrimonial middle class emerged, controlling 30 to 40% of national wealth through home ownership, pension funds, and small business equity. However, this egalitarian era proved temporary. Since 1980, inequality has resurged dramatically, led by Anglo-American economies. Piketty identifies three crucial factors behind this reversal: the Cold War's ideological paralysis that discouraged experimentation with property arrangements, the failure to develop effective transnational governance mechanisms to regulate increasingly mobile capital, and growing educational disparities that created new social hierarchies based on credentials and knowledge capital. Perhaps most significant is the complete transformation of political alignments. During the post-war decades, left-wing parties consistently performed best among working-class and less educated voters, while right-wing parties dominated among the educated elite. By the 2010s, this pattern had inverted entirely, creating what Piketty terms a system of multiple elites. The highly educated Brahmin left, concentrated in academia, culture, and public sector, now opposes the commercial, financial, merchant right, while those lacking either educational or financial capital feel increasingly alienated from both camps. This realignment has profound implications for democratic stability and the future of redistributive politics. The collapse of Soviet communism in 1989-1991 fundamentally transformed global politics in ways that continue to reverberate today. While communism's failure thoroughly discredited centralized state ownership and planned economies, it simultaneously unleashed new forms of hypercapitalism that created unprecedented levels of inequality, most dramatically in Russia and China. This transition period marked not just an economic shift, but a complete reorganization of social and political structures across the former communist world. Russia's transformation from Soviet-era relative equality to oligarchic kleptocracy wasn't an inevitable outcome, but resulted from specific policy choices in the crucial early 1990s. The shock therapy privatization program, strongly advocated by Western advisors, allowed a small group of well-connected individuals to seize control of vast state assets at fire sale prices. Progressive taxation was explicitly rejected in favor of flat tax rates, while social welfare programs were dramatically scaled back. By the 2000s, Russian billionaires' wealth had reached an astronomical 30-40% of national income, 3 to 4 times higher than levels seen in Western countries. Perhaps most troubling, Russian offshore assets now equal or exceed all legally held financial assets within Russia itself, creating a system where tax avoidance and capital flight have become normalized behaviors. This has created a peculiar form of capitalism where property rights remain contingent on political loyalty. China, learning from the Soviet Union's collapse, took a markedly different approach, developing a novel regime that combined Communist Party leadership with a carefully managed mixed economy. While public ownership declined from 70% in 1978 to approximately 30% by the mid-2000s, this level has remained remarkably stable since then, providing the state with substantial economic intervention power despite operating within a predominantly capitalist framework. The Chinese state maintains control over strategic sectors like banking, energy, and telecommunications, while allowing private enterprise to flourish in consumer goods and services. However, China has experienced dramatic inequality growth, with its income distribution now approaching American levels despite being the most egalitarian of major economies in the early 1980s. The Gini coefficient has risen from 0.3 in 1978 to over 0.5 today. Across Eastern Europe, post-communist disillusionment has fueled the rise of social nativism, political movements that combine redistributive policies for native populations with strong hostility toward immigrants and minorities. In Poland and Hungary, parties like PiS and Fidesz have implemented generous family benefits, pension increases, and public sector wage hikes while simultaneously attacking refugees, NGOs, and globalized elites. These parties have effectively combined economic populism with cultural conservatism, creating a powerful political formula that has proven extremely difficult for opposition parties to counter. Similar patterns have emerged in Western democracies, where disadvantaged classes increasingly feel abandoned by traditional left parties that have transformed into representatives of the educated urban elite. This has created a political vacuum that nationalist movements have successfully exploited by promising to protect both cultural identity and economic security. The legacy of communism's collapse thus extends far beyond economics, reshaping political alignments and challenging assumptions about the natural progression toward liberal democracy. Piketty doesn't merely diagnose problems. He offers a comprehensive alternative vision he calls participatory socialism. This approach seeks to transcend both capitalism and Soviet-style communism through two complementary mechanisms: social ownership through power sharing in firms, and temporary ownership through progressive wealth taxation and universal capital endowments. Unlike previous socialist models, this vision maintains markets and private property while fundamentally restructuring power relations and wealth distribution. First, Piketty proposes extending the German-Nordic model of co-management, giving workers half of board seats in all private firms above a certain size threshold. This would encourage worker involvement in long-term strategy while counterbalancing harmful shareholder short-termism. Drawing from successful examples in Germany and Scandinavia, this model has demonstrated improved corporate sustainability and worker satisfaction without sacrificing economic efficiency. To address the limitation that shareholders still maintain tie-breaking votes in the German system, he suggests complementary reforms like reducing wealth inequality through progressive taxation and setting voting rights ceilings for large shareholders. These ceilings would prevent any single shareholder from controlling more than 10% of voting rights, regardless of their ownership stake. Second, Piketty advocates progressive wealth taxation to prevent unlimited wealth concentration. His proposed schedule starts at just 0.1% for wealth below the national average, rising to 1% at twice the average, 10% at 100 times the average, and 90% for billionaires. This carefully calibrated system would substantially reduce taxes for 80 to 90% of people while dramatically decreasing wealth concentration at the top. Historical examples, such as the high marginal tax rates in the United States during the 1950s and 1960s, demonstrate that such progressive taxation can coexist with robust economic growth. The revenues from these wealth taxes would fund a universal capital endowment for each young adult at age 25, equivalent to approximately 60% of average adult wealth, roughly 120,000 in European countries. This would enable the bottom 50% to acquire significant assets and fully participate in economic life, transforming traditional one-time land reforms into a permanent process affecting all forms of capital. Such endowments could be used for education, housing, entrepreneurship, or other investments in economic mobility. These core proposals would be complemented by additional democratic reforms: progressive income taxes reaching 90% on the highest incomes, inheritance taxes structured to promote wealth circulation, and a progressive carbon tax accounting for individual carbon footprints. Educational reforms would ensure equal per student investment across social classes, while democratic equality vouchers would give each citizen equal resources, approximately $7 per person per year, to support political movements and media organizations, reducing the outsized influence of wealthy donors in democratic discourse. Piketty emphasizes that these proposals are not utopian, but build upon existing institutions and historical precedents. The combination of worker co-management, progressive taxation, and universal capital endowments would create a more dynamic and equitable form of capitalism while preserving innovation and entrepreneurship. The final piece of Piketty's vision addresses the fundamental contradiction of our global system. While goods, services, and capital flow freely across borders, fiscal, social, and legal systems remain matters of national sovereignty. This arrangement increasingly limits states' ability to implement just policies and has worsened contradictions that threaten the global order. For example, multinational corporations can easily shift profits to low-tax jurisdictions while nations struggle to fund social programs and infrastructure, creating a race to the bottom in corporate taxation. Piketty proposes replacing existing trade agreements with more ambitious treaties for co-development that promote equitable and sustainable development through verifiable common goals in taxation and carbon emissions. These treaties would establish minimum corporate tax rates, harmonized carbon pricing, and shared standards for labor rights and environmental protection. Unlike current trade deals that primarily focus on reducing barriers to commerce, these agreements would prioritize social justice and ecological sustainability. For Europe specifically, he suggests creating a European Assembly composed of both national parliamentarians and European Parliament members. This hybrid body would bridge the democratic deficit in EU governance while maintaining connections to national politics. The Assembly would approve four key common taxes: on corporate profits with a minimum rate of 25%, high incomes targeting the top 1%, large fortunes through a progressive wealth tax, and carbon emissions with border adjustments, generating revenues of about 4% of GDP. This social federalist approach would demonstrate that internationalism can deliver fiscal, social, and environmental justice rather than just merciless competition. By establishing common standards and shared revenue streams, it would prevent regulatory arbitrage and tax competition between nations. The model would allow the Eurozone to issue common bonds at identical interest rates without mutualizing existing debts, ending the dysfunctional austerity policies that have fueled nationalist movements across the continent. This would particularly benefit southern European countries that have faced punitive borrowing costs. While Piketty acknowledges that his proposals face significant political obstacles, especially from financial interests and certain member states, he emphasizes that history shows multiple trajectories are always possible. He points to historical precedents like the New Deal and post-war European Reconstruction as examples of transformative change emerging from crisis. The real danger lies in intensified competition through fiscal and social dumping that fuels nationalist conflicts already visible across continents. Rising inequality, environmental degradation, and the resurgence of populist movements demonstrate the unsustainability of the current system. Only a participatory internationalist socialism based on social federalist structures can overcome these contradictions and create a more just global order. This would require new democratic institutions at the transnational level, transparent decision-making processes, and mechanisms for citizen participation in economic governance. Such reforms would help restore faith in international cooperation while addressing the legitimate concerns about sovereignty and democratic accountability that have fueled Euroscepticism and nationalism. Piketty concludes that history is fundamentally the struggle of ideologies and the quest for justice. Ideas matter profoundly. Social position alone cannot forge theories of just society, property, borders, taxes, education, wages, or democracy. This understanding challenges traditional materialist interpretations that reduce historical change to pure economic forces. Instead, Piketty demonstrates how ideological frameworks, from religious doctrines to secular political philosophies, have shaped society's approaches to inequality and justice throughout history. The communist disaster of the 20th century serves as a crucial case study, illustrating how ideological certainty can lead to catastrophic outcomes when divorced from democratic deliberation and empirical reality. This historical lesson demands we carefully scrutinize today's inequality regimes and their justifications. From Nordic social democracy to American capitalism, from Chinese state capitalism to European welfare states, each system rests on distinct ideological foundations that merit rigorous analysis to understand which institutional arrangements truly promote human emancipation. Unlike traditional class struggle, ideological struggle involves a more nuanced interplay of ideas, requiring shared knowledge, respect, and democratic deliberation. Piketty emphasizes that no single group or perspective possesses absolute truth about justice. This approach necessitates open dialogue between different worldviews, from market liberals to social democrats, from environmentalists to technological optimists. The key lies in finding common ground while acknowledging the legitimacy of diverse perspectives on fairness and progress. What makes capital and ideology particularly powerful is its unprecedented combination of rigorous empirical research with moral clarity and practical vision. Through detailed historical analysis spanning centuries and continents, Piketty demonstrates that extreme inequality isn't inevitable, but rather the product of specific political choices and ideological frameworks. From medieval European societies to modern global capitalism, he traces how different societies have justified and challenged their inequality regimes. His work transcends traditional economic analysis to become a profound contribution to our understanding of how societies organize themselves and what alternatives might be possible. By examining successful examples of reducing inequality, such as post-war social democratic policies in Europe or progressive era reforms in the United States, Piketty provides concrete evidence that positive change is achievable through democratic processes and ideological evolution. In a world of growing inequality and political polarization, Piketty's insights offer both a diagnosis of our current predicament and a pathway toward a more equitable global order. He argues for a new progressive universalism that combines ambitious social policies with respect for cultural diversity and democratic deliberation. This vision includes specific proposals like educational justice, worker co-determination, and progressive wealth taxation, while remaining open to democratic experimentation and adaptation to local contexts.